in the journey of Alzheimer's, both my mother's journey and my family caring for her and watching this wonderful woman, you know, start to fade away like a ship that's disappearing into the mist, ever so slowly but ever so surely, you know, propelled by some implacable wind that you can't control, and yet you have to face it. For me, the only way to face it was with faith. Without that faith, I would have been in despair. And
absolutely.
In a way, that's a miracle too. You know, I reconciled with my mother in many ways towards the end of this journey, and I think it's about all of our need to reconcile with our people who we need to forgive and people who need to forgive us. And that's just the part of growing closer.
You're listening to the Reframing Ministries podcast, providing strength for today and hope for tomorrow for caregivers and their families. Here's our host, Colleen Swindoll Thompson.
Hello and welcome again to a wonderful time together with Reframing Ministry. I am Colleen Thompson, and today's guest is going to speak into, I believe, every life that is listening, because at some point, as my friend says, we are in a trial, we have gone through a trial, or we are about to go through a trial. And Edward Grennan, editor-in-chief at Guidepost Magazine, is my guest. Edward, thank you for being with me today.
It's a real pleasure to be here and to talk to you and your audience.
Thank you. Edward has put together a book, A Journey of Faith, A Mother's Alzheimer's, A Son's Love, and His Search for Answers. Edward, I would like to just start out right now with your heart in the book.
I wanted to speak to people. It really started, the introductory story in the book is about a tiny little incident. Where I didn't remember if I put on my dog's collar light before I let her out one dark winter night. And I always put her collar light on, you know, and so I can watch her out in the yard and make sure everything's okay. And it triggered in me just a sudden realization that maybe I don't remember things the way I used to remember them. And having a history of Alzheimer's in my family, that became almost a phobic fear. And I wrote a little piece about it in Guidepost, just a little two-page for saying, you know, in the end, you know, my recourse and my strength is to rely on my faith and the power of prayer in these instances. And I began to think a little bit about my future. Was I susceptible to this disease that had affected so many people in my family, including my mother? And the response to that from the Guidepost audience, which is about 3 million readers per issue, was incredible. Like I didn't think I'd get that kind of response. And I realized how many people are going through this. And then I realized not just going through caring for a loved one with some form of dementia, but also just the caregiving challenge that so many Americans are going through. And I began to realize that we are a nation of caregivers. Someone is caring for a child, a spouse, a father, a grandfather, a pet. You know, we are consumed. Almost every single person spends at least part of their day caring for someone above and beyond the normal care you give to loved ones. And I thought, you know, where's God in this challenge? You know, and that's really why I wrote the book, because, you know, someone said to me when the book came out a couple months ago, she said, you know, this isn't a book about Alzheimer's. You know, it's a book about hope. And
that's
what I wanted to help to give to people in a way that feels real and honest. And I do that by telling my own story, both of my family dealing with and of the ordeal that my mother and her sisters and her brothers all went through, but also, you know, talking about some of my own personal spiritual challenges in life, including my journey with addiction and recovery, and my own quest to find out, you know, what the future holds for me. And at the end of the book, I realized the only thing that future holds for me for certain is God's love. Whatever becomes of me and my mind in the coming years, the only certainty about the future is that God will be there as he was in the past and as he is in the present. And that's why I finally was able to let go of this kind of terror of losing my mind. That in the end, faith is, for all the science and all the wonders of medicine, you know, the one certainty is faith.
One of the quotes that I found so fascinating, it's your chapter on miracles, and you quote St. Augustine, and you say, miracles are not a contradiction to nature. They are only in contradiction to what we know of nature. And that's essentially what you're saying.
Right. We know so little. And which is why miracles amaze us and transform us. I think a miracle is any event or circumstance that you can't explain that changes you for the
That's
better,
wonderful.
For the good, that deepens your faith. Those are miracles. People will say, well, you know, the miracles of the Bible don't happen today. People aren't healed and Lazarus and people aren't raised from the dead. And yet, you know, I was raised from the dead. You know, in my depths of addiction, I was a dead person. You know, I had, my life had evaporated into a haze of addiction. I feel like Lazarus. I feel like I've been raised from the dead. And that's a miracle. And there are millions of people who have overcome problems like addiction. And each and every one of them is a miracle as real and as dramatic as the miracles of the Old Testament and the New Testament. And I think we lose sight of that fact. And in those moments, those miraculous moments are the moments that change us spiritually and deepen us and deepen our closeness with God. And in the journey of Alzheimer's, both my mother's journey and my family caring for her and watching this wonderful woman, you know, start to fade away like a ship that's disappearing into the mist, ever so slowly, but ever so surely, you know, propelled by some implacable wind, that you can't control. And yet you have to face it. For me, the only way to face it was with faith. Without that faith, I would have been in despair.
And absolutely.
In a way, that's a miracle too. You know, I reconciled with my mother in many ways towards the end of this journey. And I think it, you know, it's about all of our need to reconcile with our, you know, people who we need to forgive and people who need to forgive us. And that's just the part of growing closer.
And growing deeper.
Yes.
Let's go back to your childhood. You were so close to your mother growing up. You write in the book how similar you both are. You also had a brother with Down syndrome who had, that's a whole other experience that you lived with and through that you carry with you. And then you had the addiction part. And so let's just start with after you get out of college and you're kind of wandering around and you start in with alcohol and then that takes you on a road. Talk to us about that winding road.
Well, I think I started with alcohol when I was about 13 years old. And I remember the day, the night it happened, and we were out with some other kids out in an apple orchard that was adjacent to the subdivision I grew up in outside of Detroit. And a guy had stolen a bottle of liquor from his, mm-hmm. you know, it was a real cold, crisp fall night. And there was a full moon out. And a guy had stolen a bottle of liquor from his parents' liquor cabinet. Sure. We were passing around and it got to me. It's a typical story. And it got to me, and I remember tipping that bottle up to my lips. And really, the moon was right behind it. And, you know, it just felt like I was, this substance illuminated me. And I remember thinking, I want to feel this way all the time. And I tried. And it nearly killed me 25 years later. But I think, and it was funny because I remember now the name of the liquor was called Old Granddad. And I did not know at the time that my grandfather had been an alcoholic. And it was almost a sign to me of the danger I was in. I didn't know it at the time, and it was a path that I had to go down. And I hate to say I was glad to go down it, but it did bring me out the other side, in a kind of sobriety that, in a kind of spiritual life that I didn't have at the time. And I continued to use alcohol as a supplement, a crutch, you know, something that, you know, I now know substituted for faith, you know. And I think, you know, drunks like me, are on some sort of, you know, journey. I think we're seeking a spiritual enlightenment, and we've just diverted ourselves along the wrong path, a destructive path, but, and yet we are seeking something. I didn't realize that. I thought at the time I was seeking relief from anxiety or guilt or insecurity, but I was really, and those are the symptoms, but what I was really seeking was something I could believe in, you know, and something that would, some God that would believe in me. And, you know, I thought that if God existed, he was indifferent to my existence, and why shouldn't I be indifferent to his? And, you know, that kind of antagonism towards God lasted a long time with me, really, in many ways, until I got to Guideposts. You know, I was barely sober when I did. And I never thought I didn't know what Guidepost was. I thought it was a travel magazine. And I thought, oh, maybe I'll get some trips out of this. And
it'd be a good name for a travel magazine.
It was. If you change travel to journey, that's exactly what it is. It's a journey.
Yes.
It was there hearing the stories of the people in this country who have found faith in their everyday living, and how that allows them to deal with challenges big and small. It opened me up to a whole new world, that and my stumbling through early sobriety at the time. You ask about my brother, though, and my relationship with my mother, and that, to go back to that time, I had a brother who was 4 years older than me who had Down syndrome. I was the youngest by far in my family. And my brother died when he was 12 years old, under some very difficult and still mysterious circumstances.
Yeah.
And, you know, my parents loved my brother Bobby. You know, they were very religious. My parents, they were Catholics. And when Bobby was born, you know, the pastor came and said, you know, the Catholic Church has institutions that can care for these children, whole orders of nuns whose sole devotion in this world is caring for children with this sort of disability. And I'm sure they were honest and sincere about that. They thought they were doing the best thing. Well, it's the closest I ever saw my parents come to throwing a priest out of their house. You know, they just said, no, we will care for this. He is our son. God gave him to us, and we will care for him. And so it was, you know, Bobby was completely, you know, at the center of our family, really. And, sure. You know, when he died, I think my mother and I grew very, very close, because as I said, I was the youngest by far. I was probably not exactly a planned pregnancy. And, you know, she needed another little boy to love. And that was me. So we grew very, very close. Years later, when I see her beginning to fade because of this terrible disease of Alzheimer's, it was really difficult. It was wrenching. It was primal. And it brought back all those memories of my brother and that traumatic period when he had disappeared. We didn't know what happened to him for a month.
Yeah. Help me put that together, because I think that goes back to the why question that you faced on various levels in your life or various circumstances, because he disappeared and then he was not found. And then they found him on the lake. What time period was that? Because the why, how could God do this, especially to Bobby?
I know. You know, my brother disappeared. It was a winter day in Michigan, towards the end of winter. And he went to school in the afternoon. He went to a school called St. Barbara's, which was for Down syndrome children. And he went in the afternoon. The bus would pick him up around 12:30, and he would go to school and come home around the time I did from school. And but he was, you know, he had developed far more than doctors and the church had predicted. And he was free to go and take a walk in the neighborhood on his own. And he often did. And that day he went down the street and we never saw him again. It was just, it was as if he dropped off the face of the earth. There was a construction crew building a house who said they saw him. They shared a sandwich with him. We didn't know he caged food from the construction workers in the neighborhood.
They are sneaky. I know that.
I know. And he had a little bit of a, not a secret life, but there he had, you know, he had people he saw along the way on our street. And my mother was always, my parents, it was a different time. And they were always pretty confident. And they'd certainly believe God would look out for Bobby. But he didn't come back that day. I remember being pulled out of school and coming home, and I hadn't any idea what had happened. And there were news trucks and reporters all over the lawn. You know, the FBI showed up. You know, there was the sheriffs and the state police and the local cops. And it was just unbelievable what was going on. I thought, well, I know where Bobby, I know all his hiding places. I'll find him. Don't worry. And of course, you know, I was 8 years old and I wasn't able to help him. There was a little lake in the center of the subdivision, a man-made lake, in which they searched, you know, that day. They saw no footprints. It was snow-covered, and there were no footprints. But they searched all over the lake. The next day, they did it on horseback. You know, the ice was solid. This was Michigan in the 60s, and it was freezing. And, you know, kind of assumed kidnapping. And, you know, they felt that maybe someone picked him up. And there was a woman, a very kind of eccentric woman, who said that she saw him talking to a stranger in a car. But leads led nowhere. When that lake thawed a month later at the beginning of the Michigan spring, they went with scuba divers to check again. And the one thing that chief of detectives of Oakland County said at the time, there's one thing we know. You know, Bobby Grinnan is not in that lake. And a week or so later, and two girls out for a walk saw a body floating in that water. And it was Bobby. And no one could really tell with certainty how he got into that lake. So, you know, that was, you know, what my parents went through was just astonishing. And how they survived it, and how the marriage survived it, and how the family survived it is a kind of a miracle as well. My parents were deeply religious, and it was their faith that held them. I mean, usually, I mean, there's two things. If you have a Down syndrome or a disabled child in some way, the chances of a marriage surviving that, right, you know, are low. Many marriages break up over a disabled child. But anytime you lose a child, that also breaks up marriages. And my parents had both, and they stayed together. I didn't appreciate it at the time, and I didn't appreciate it for a long time, but it was faith that held that marriage together, you know, in that sense that they could survive even the most devastating tragedy because they had God.
It's interesting that you mentioned that.
Yeah.
Because they didn't have answers.
They didn't.
One of the most challenging things in life is when there is no answer, when there is no why. Why did God let this happen to Bobby? I just recently talked to two very close friends, both of whom had grandchildren or a great-grandchild and a grandchild stillborn, full term. There's no why. There's no answer. And so they have empty arms and a full nursery, and it's over. But it's never over. So how did your parents move through that? And how can you equip others moving through that right now with when it's never over? The church wants to say, oh, well, it'll be over. Or aren't you over your grief yet or whatever? No, it's never over fully.
No, it becomes, you know, your life, you know, your life isn't a half hour TV show where you move on to the next episode and the next episode. You know, your life is an accumulation of the experiences you go through, good and bad. And they don't, I like to, you know, the idea of getting over something or going through it. It becomes part of who you are. All of you, we are people who are scarred by life. Yes. And those scars don't go away. They heal, but they don't go away. And those scars, in a sense, you know, strengthen us the way they strengthen a healed or knitted bone or the skin. We get through that because we have something more powerful than our, you know, suffering that propels us spiritually, you know, if we are strong in our faith. And I'm not strong in my faith. I'm full of doubts. Yeah, I have those unanswered questions that I think, you know, are tormenting me. And life has many more unanswered questions than answers. You know, life is full of non-answers. And, you know, until we accept that we don't have to have the answer to have the truth, we're very unhappy. We will not be content. We will not have peace inside until we accept that there is so much that we don't know, but we believe God has a plan that we may never understand. But if we believe that it is there, then it makes life fulfilling. It makes life beautiful, even with its scars. You know, I've thought about, you know, Christ suffered for me. And that, you know, Christ didn't suffer for me. Christ suffers with me. Yes. And knowing that is what gives life meaning. And it gives life purpose, and it gives life a depth that I think, for me at least, it wouldn't have otherwise.
Visit us at reframingministries.com for all of Colleen's interviews, articles, recommended resources, and more. While you're there, don't forget to subscribe and receive our free 5-day video devotional series, where Colleen provides pointers for navigating daily life and struggles.
Interesting that you say we have to trust, we have to believe, because in the reframing process, you're trusting an architect to renovate a home. And the couple can't see the finished product except on paper. Like, we can't see eternity except on paper, as Christ gives us scripture. So we trust in what we can't see, that will come about and come to fruition. The same is true as that couple waits for that wonderful home to come together. Our home is in heaven, but we have peace because of what's promised in the paper, on paper through scripture and the truths that are there. Like, God is our great architect and great physician. I want to go into your journey with Alzheimer's, because that is an increasing diagnosis. The interesting statistic that I had also come across is that by 2050, that number is expected to double or triple, which is $355 billion economic impact. That's a very large statistic. Without a cure. And of course, they are doing brain research and all kinds of new ways to help cellular regeneration and all of that. But for you and me today, and those who are listening or watching, they have a parent or a great-grandparent that is slowly fading like a ship in the night, and they don't know what to say, and their kids have memories with them, and there's unresolved tensions. There's family dynamics. I mean, it brings everything to the surface that was once swept under the rug, I believe, and have seen and experienced. So as you all started, you and your sisters, they sound like a wonderful team because they worked together.
Much better than me. I was the weak link.
But you know what? There was love there, and there was a connection that you contributed. So you were just as important. And I love in this book, by the way, you end each chapter with several tips that are very practical. I loved the one on say, I love you. With unresolved issues, that person is passing. Say, I love you a lot, always. And so I started doing that, Edward. Just texted my dad the other day, Dad, I love you. And I'm pretty good about it, but now I'm intentional about it. So you have tips all through here.
Exactly. You were intentional about it. My mother and I were not, my family, we didn't say that much. We didn't say I love you that much. And one of the things I learned, and I learned it from her caregivers in the memory care unit, where she, you know, that they said they love to hear that. I mean, part of the, I think the premise of this book is that, and what I learned from my mother's journey and the journey of other people, because this book also deals with everyone from Glenn Campbell to Amy Grant.
Yes.
They're all people who have told their stories and guideposts about their journeys with an Alzheimer's loved one. You know, in the case of Glenn Campbell, it was his wife who told her story. And there is a core to us. There's a core that Alzheimer's cannot destroy. And that is faith and love, which are the same thing in their essence. And that as much as the Alzheimer's, you know, that strips away, you know, who we are, it can't strip that away. And I have some stories about my mother's faith that was there at the very end, even when all these other attributes of who she was on this earth deteriorated, her faith did not. You could still touch that. And the way you get there, and one of the most practical things I learned was learning to be present, which sounds easy and is hard as you can imagine. Yep. You know, and because these neurodegenerative diseases really affect your relationship with the person, because it's happening to someone you love, spouse, and in many cases your parent. And I wanted to correct my mother. When I would go see my mother, I'd stop by and she'd say, oh, I had a conversation with Uncle, you know, Bob. And I would think, Uncle Bob's been dead for 20 years. You didn't have a conversation. And I would say, no, Mom, you didn't talk to Uncle Bob. You know, that's not true. And it was my attempt to fix her, you know. And it only made her more anxious when I said things like, that's not true, or that's not really happening. And what I realized was that the best thing to do was to say, well, how's Uncle Bob doing? You know, what's he
yep.
up to? Does he still wear those crazy ties? And be there in her reality. Don't try to, you know, I wanted to bring her back to my reality because I wanted her to be the mother I grew up loving. And it was very hard to let go. You know, to let go of her in a way, to let and not meet her in that moment. And if she said the sky was, you know, was orange, the sky was orange. You know, even if I looked out the window and it was blue, you know, she was going on a journey, and she needed, you know, me to be with her on that journey and not trying to stop her, because there's no stopping Alzheimer's. And she was exploring, you know, parts of her mind that she hadn't explored in years, and memories and impressions and words that were coming bubbling up from these almost ancient memories as they faded away. And so learning to be present and always saying, I love you. I read a piece, a study yesterday saying, you know, with all the treatments that there are now for Alzheimer's, still the most effective treatment is empathy. That treating it's so hard because Alzheimer's patients can become, you know, it almost feels demonic. You know, they can become, and my mother wasn't too much like this, but so many stories I've heard of parents who've become abusive, right. Even, you know, violent.
Yes.
And that the best, you know, still the best thing is to show them love. That love is still the most powerful medicine, and to let them know that they are loved, because they're going through tremendous anxiety because they inside know what's happening to them. And, you know, to ease their journey, to hold their hand, to tell you that you love them, and to be there in the moment, in the present with them is the best thing you can do. But it's also, for me, the hardest. It was the hardest.
Well, you said it was your attempt to fix what was happening. And I think that is an attempt. That is one of our first go-tos, is to correct or to set back onto the right path. And that's not going to happen. My dad has a definition of love, an acrostic, which is to listen, to observe, to value, and to encourage. And that's what presence is, listening, observing,
right.
Valuing, and encouraging.
Right.
Tell me a couple other go-tos for people who are on that, I'm going to fix it, because we lost my father-in-law several years ago with a 10-year battle with dementia. So we saw all of that and all of the whole trying to fix and trying to, don't you remember? No, they don't remember. Stop saying that, don't you remember?
Right.
They're not going to remember. Right. What other things were helpful for you?
Telling stories, you know, I would sit and I'd tell my mother a story about something that happened, like a vacation we took in Stone Harbor, New Jersey, went down on the Jersey Shore, or the time we went up north in Michigan, or I'd talk about the time my little league team was in the championship game and she came and she cheered for us. And, you know, I would tell these stories to her and she could sometimes remember that, yeah, you guys almost won the Little League championship that year in Michigan. And she might remember sitting in the center. She might say, yes, you hit a home run. And I think, no, I didn't hit a home run, but let's go there. Let's say I hit
all
a home
the
run.
Better. You, thanks, I, mom, I did.
You were cheering and screaming, you know, storytelling and let, you know, I found that I'd tell part of a story and she'd say she remembered something and she'd tell part of a story. A lot of it was completely divorced from reality, but it was, you know, that storytelling that we're going back and forth on, it really worked. I had to let go of the fact that it was, you know, as a writer, I want to be factual and these were not factual retellings of, you know, my life with my mother, but she loved doing that. And she loved, yeah. It was like a game. And part of my, you know, my mom was extremely smart. And, you know, she'd been a quiz show champion in the 1950s. She was really sharp. And
she was one tough little cookie, as I read the book, shoveling snow in her 70s. I'm impressed.
Tough Irish woman. And she, graduated high school and she was 15. She was very smart. And I always looked at my mom and thought, part of her knows we're playing a game because she's not well. This part of her brain that was still there that was objective and you know, like a lot of, Alzheimer's patients, there's good days and bad days. There's good hours and bad hours. So there are times when they're almost completely present and, you know, because it's not completely linear, this degeneration, this degeneration of the brain. So you have to learn to be present in the good days and the bad days, the good hours and the bad hours. And, you know, if you can have a fairly rational conversation for a while, then that's great. You need to do that. You know, I tried never to treat my mom like she was sick, you know, and I still don't like the idea of it even being a disease, but it's, you know, like the brain, like so many other parts of your body can, you know, fall apart as you get older, whether it's your knees or your brain or your, you know, it's the body parts that, you know, we're not built to last forever. And that's part of, you know, this journey is for me was just sort of coming to terms with the question of mortality, that life is not life on this earth is a passing shadow. It's a flickering light, which fills us with love and joy at many times, but it's not permanent. And I don't think you realize that until you watch your parent pass on. I think most human beings learn the mortality of life when they see their parents' lives end. It's an incredible experience to lose your parents. And everybody goes through it, or almost everybody goes through it.
And I think another thing that y'all did was you told, you're talking about telling stories. You're talking about not trying to fix. An essential piece I have found is you worked with people on the accounts and the end of life decisions, which if those are not done, then the law will take over and it will not be what you want. We've had to put together a family trust for my son, a disability family trust. And so we, our four other kids, we said, okay, so at the end of life, do not resuscitate. I don't want to keep going. I want to be in heaven. And they're like, we don't want to talk about this stuff. Tell us how you and your sisters did that, because that has to happen.
And so I was so lucky. As I said, I'm the youngest. So my brother is a lawyer. He's married to a lawyer
who's
the most practical woman I've ever met in my life. And my sister is a school psychologist. I mean, what a support group.
Yeah, you've got your own AA group right there.
I know. Really knew it was. And they lived in Michigan where my mother lived. I was in New York City. I was a writer and an editor. You know, what good am I? But I was also my mother's favorite. That's not a boast. Everybody in the family knew that. We joked about it all my life, that I'm mom's favorite. And you know, they were able to take these decisions. But even then, looking back, when we do, you know, the after action, thinking about my mother's journey and how we might want our journeys to proceed towards the end, we were late on a lot of stuff. I mean, our denial, you know, and that's a huge part of the disease of Alzheimer's or any form of dementia. My mother certainly denied that she had it. Even though both of her sisters, one of her brothers, and her father all died of in memory care or of Alzheimer's. And, you know, her denial was powerful, was bulletproof. She just wasn't going to give in to this disease. And we knew, we saw her sisters go through this, and we remembered our grandfather going through it. And yet we were so resistant to things like getting her off the road. You know, after
that's a huge several one. Accidents. The keys, yep.
And, you know, and taking those car keys away, which was one of the most traumatic experiences of my life, mainly because we couldn't get them. She wouldn't give it up. In the end, she just said, "No, you cannot have my keys in my car," and we had to use other methods eventually to do that. Yep. And eventually, realizing she needed to be somewhere other than her house, she lived right next door to my brother and his wife Tony. So they could keep an eye on her. But even then, you know, two things happened. She almost burned the house down. And that's an interesting story because she was rummaging through the attic. We don't know how the fire started. We think maybe a lamp fell over and the light bulb was hot and set fire to the. And when my nieces, my brother and sister-in-law's kids came over the next morning to bring her some baked goods. They saw this damage from a fire and the house should have burned down. And my brother went over and said, "How did this happen?" My mother didn't have much recollection. And she said, "But two men showed up." And this was probably about 2 a.m. She said, "Two men in suits showed up and put the fire out." And so my brother thought, okay, that's, you know, and you know, it's a small, they live in a small suburb and they know everybody. And so they talked to the police and the fire department. And they all said, no, nobody showed up. And talked to the neighbors, nobody showed up. And my mother swore that these two men came and put the fire out. And there was no evidence of it. And, you know, it was my sister who said, well, those two were angels.
And I was just going to say that,
you know, because there was no other explanation for it. And then probably the last thing that really pushed us over our edge, I'm talking about my brother, Bobby. My mother, and she was probably approaching 80 by now, called the police one day and said a little boy was missing. And of course, a police department, when they hear that, They have to go into full mobilization. And they came dashing out to my mother's house. They started to get a search crew together. She said he walked off into the woods and she couldn't really tell them when. And they were going to put a helicopter up in the air. I mean, they went into full mobilization until they realized. And my mother eventually said, oh, he's my son. He's 12 years old. My mother did not have a 12-year-old son, sure, of course. And the police began to say, there's something wrong here. You know, and they got a hold of my brother and he came out right away and the situation was settled. But to see that my mother was trapped in the worst moment of her life. And it was heartbreaking. And you ask yourself, how could God do this to her? How could he do that? How could he allow? You know, it's one thing to say, well, Alzheimer's is a terrible disease. But when you see a woman like my mother, you know, trapped in that terrible moment when she lost her son, you really begin to doubt that God is a God of love. I did, at least. And it was also at that moment that we realized that we were being reckless and not finding a care facility for her. And at that point, we did. We found a very good faith-based memory care, brand new. She was the first, they said she was the first class. And it was great. You know, and then I thought later, well, you know, and this was transformative for her to go into this place where she really felt safe. And, you know, I began to think, well, maybe God is a God of love. I mean, because he is taking care of her in ways that we can't anymore, you know. And so maybe I can't answer the question why God allows diseases into the world, but I can believe in the fact that he is here to help us. Face those diseases, and it's not for me to know anything more than that. Right. So I think one of the big things everybody faces in this disease is denial, and denial not just of what's happening to your loved one, but in my case, denial that God could do a better job of taking care of my mother than I could.
Oh, and we so want to give them a hand. I mean, come on. And then you look at your life or my life, and I think, how good is that going to be, Colleen? I don't think that he can use your help because of the trouble that you get in on your own. As we wrap this up, and there's so many more things, like just dealing with emotions and how the process and the degeneration brings up emotion in the caregivers and how we deal with that. It all goes back to the Lord. For anyone who is watching or listening right now, what are a couple nuggets that you could give them? Because they may be carrying a load of laundry that they've washed that is full of yucky underwear, dirty shirts, holes, ripped things, listening to a story about someone who's long been passed, and they're rock solid believing that they're still around, and it's exhausting, and they just don't know how to go on.
I think one thing I've heard about, and you hear about it more and more, is respite care. And you know, you have, you know, my wife always called it the oxygen mask solution. And when you're on an airplane and they tell you it's going to crash, you know, or they're in trouble, you know, they want you to put your oxygen mask on first before you help another person, particularly a child or an elderly person. And you have to remember that you have to be strong to care with love, you know, to care for your loved one with the kind of love, compassion, empathy, and understanding that is required. And it is so difficult. And really, you know, being loving can be stressful sometimes, given the circumstances. If you're exhausted, you know, if your own physical health is being run down, you have to. That's your oxygen mask. You have to care for yourself first. So one of the things that I think I've learned from my family and other families who've gone through this is the real need to take care of yourself before you take care of that loved one, and give yourself breaks and give yourself renewal, and you know. The other things is other people. You know, caregiving can be a terribly isolating experience. You know, people stop seeing their friends. People stop going to church. All that sustenance that we need, the energy and strength we draw from other people, from friends and other loved ones, sometimes we isolate ourselves from that when we're caregiving. And that is, again, another way that that only undermines your capacity, you know, to give the loving care that your loved one requires. Remember, taking care of yourself is taking care of your loved one. And don't be afraid to ask for help. You know, you think the burden is so great you can't possibly share with anyone else because it wouldn't be fair. Well, that's not true. You know, what I think you'll find, what I found, there are so many people, if only they're there to listen to you, even if you need 10 minutes of a phone, you know, call with an old friend to just say, this is what I'm going through. I don't expect you to fix it. Don't even try. Just listen. Right. And you'll do that later in your life as you give that care back to the next caregiver who needs you. But you need people to talk to, just to talk, just to release the feelings that you have. And, you know, another nugget is guilt is the great killer of love, of caring. It's hard not to feel guilty when you see someone else suffering. I just think it's natural. If you love someone and they're suffering, you feel guilty because you didn't stop it. You can't cure it or fix it. And, you know, guilt is a burden you don't need to be carrying when you're caregiving. You have to be there in the moment, and whatever, you know, responsibility you want to assign to yourself for the other person suffering is just gets in the way. You know, guilt can't be a part of this relationship. And sometimes loved ones, particularly ones with dementia, will say really terrible things to you. You know, yeah, they'll tell you that they don't love you. They don't trust you. They think what you're trying to do for them is wrong. And all of that, you know, can tug at those guilt strings, you know, and we all have guilt, and those strings have to be cut, you know, because you push through that and you have to believe that what you're doing is what's best for your caregiver. And, you know, you'll see things in people that you didn't think existed and embrace it, you know, even if your loved one is really being difficult and vulgar sometimes. Don't judge. Do not judge a person with dementia because they're not. I'll tell you a funny story. My mother, who, you know, I never heard my mother say a bad word in her life. She did not. She never said any, not a damn, not a hell, nothing, ever. And so one day I'm visiting her care unit and, you know, her memory care unit. And this woman came in to like give her a fresh carafe of water. And she was a large woman. And she was very sweet, you know, like sugary sweet to my mom. And when she left, she was walking out the door and my mother looked at her and said, thanks a lot, fat ass. And I thought, I have never heard my mother say that word, you know, and I would never say it in front of her. Or if I did, I'd be in trouble when I was a kid. And it was just, you know, I burst out laughing. I absolutely, you know, I tried not to, but I was just laughing my head off. And my mother was laughing too. She started to laugh. I don't know if she knew what she was laughing at, you know, but she, to see me laugh, made her laugh and laugh. And we sat there laughing for like 2 minutes. It was a wonderful moment, all because my mother said something. I never thought she even knew that word or that expression. So it'll take you, and you know, it'll take your journey will go in all sorts of different directions. Believe it or not, some of it's even humorous. But you got
to
go.
A lot of it has to be humorous.
You have to go on that journey. It's a path. You can't fight it, and it's going to take you all sorts of places. Just believe that standing behind you is a loving God who's going to protect you emotionally and spiritually from what, you know, you're going through.
And who already knows what's in you and what's coming out and isn't shocked by it. And it's like, finally, you're admitting that you have very little patience, or you're wanting to fix, or you're really pissed about this situation, or you're angry because this happened years ago and now there's no result. I mean, he knows. And so he embraces us when we just will finally come to him and say, help. I can't.
Yes. It's amazing.
Edward, thank you so very much. Is there a way that people can connect with you? I know through Guideposts, but I don't know if you have other sites where you are available, where you do speaking or anything like that.
There's guidepost.org. I often publish a blog there. I write for our daily devotional book, Walking in Grace. So I can meet you there in my writing.
If you want to order the book.
What's that?
You're a wonderful writer. I love the way that you write. You tell stories so well. And this is how the book looks. I don't know if that is showing up on the screen. Yes, that's the
book. If you need to order the book, I would love for you to order the book, and that would be it. The address would be shopguideposts.org/JOF, capital JOF. Or you can order the book from Amazon in... If you order from Guideposts at shopguideposts.org, you'll get two free gifts. One is a video and one is a pamphlet of my devotionals, or a little book of devotionals. So, and if you have a story of your own, you can always send it to me. It's at egrinnan@guideposts.org. I love reading stories. I can't respond to every one of them, but it gives me strength to hear from people.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for your time. Experience. With so much on your plate, thank you for sharing this with us.
Colleen, thank you and your audience for having me.
You bet.
I truly appreciate it, and God bless you.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you again for joining us today. We hope you'll join us again for future discussions with Colleen and World Influencers. The Reframing Ministries podcast is a production of Insight for Living Ministries.